has largely been ignored, despite the levels of atrocities it has endured, both at home and as refugees. They say India needs to rethink and redraw its refugee policy, regardless of the geostrategic interest, and stand by its ethos, considering the world as a family. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, the community continues to be neglected and unseen victims of violence. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
In the downtown area of Kashmir's capital city, Srinagar, lies the centuries of traditions and legacy that came to Kashmir via Silk Route from Central Asia. This part of the main city, Srinagar, remains untouched by modernization. Set up on the banks of River Jhelum, the downtown Srinagar is home to many scholars who came to Kashmir along with their disciples to preach Islam. Some seven centuries ago, Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani came from Iran along with scores of artisans, preachers, scent makers and traditional healers. These men settled around the banks of River Jhelum and taught their specialities to the locals. And to date, these teachings are the source of survival for tens of thousands of people in Srinagar. Let's meet probably the last scent maker of Kashmir, Azizullah Khosgar. Few steps away from the shrine of Shahi Hamdan or Mir Sayyid Ali Hamadani, this is an Arkigulab Dukan or Rosewater Shop. It is a major attraction for tourists and the younger generation. The 65-year-old Khosgar's shop is filled with centuries-old jars, some empty and a few partly filled. Khosgar is the last remaining rose water maker. This shop carries 400 years of Kashmir's legacy.
For Muslims, rose water has a spiritual as well as religious significance. This shop was set in 1820, and these glass bottle jars and decanters were imported from different parts of the world. We have a collection of other fragrances besides rose water. We have been making herbal medicines, but now people prefer modern science instead of traditional methods.
The Khosgar family has been in the trade for distilling rose water for four centuries, and the entire process is done manually. His customers, however, can't do without his handmade fragrances and herbal syrups.
We have been living here for centuries, and we know the worth of his pure rose water and other products. Besides that, his herbal syrups and ointments have been healing our ailments, whether related to skin or immunity. We use his rose water during special occasions and during the holy month of Ramadan to make special drinks.
Khosgar's rose water is made specifically from Kashmiri roses and has been used for centuries to perfume shrines and mosques, since it is believed to be extracted in the best of its form. Azizullah Khosgar has acquired these skills from his forefathers who had traveled here from Turkey some 500 years ago. He says they have kept the secret method rolling from one generation to another, but he fears whether his son will take it or not and wishes that somebody comes forward and takes the legacy ahead. Khosgar says the political uncertainty, lockdowns and lack of people's interest in pure rose water have resulted in falling demand, and these reasons might sooner or later force the closure of his centuries-old business in Srinagar. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
It was the usual glad handing and bon ami for the cameras, but after a 90-minute discussion and photo op, there would have been very little of substance for Boris Johnson to claim as marquee victories for his administration. It was the reluctance of President Joe Biden to guarantee the coveted free trade agreement worth nearly £300 billion a year with London that would have been the most bitter pill to swallow. Britain's exit from the EU and the fallout from the shaky Northern Ireland Protocol has been cited as a major sticking point, though President Biden attempted to downplay the link.
There are two separate issues. On the deal with the UK, that's continued to be discussed. But on the protocols, I feel very strongly about those.
Johnson tried to shrug off suggestions the prospect of a deal were disappearing.
The Biden administration is not doing free trade deals around the world right now, but I've got absolutely every confidence that a great deal is there to be done.
Analysts across the Atlantic are certain both issues are intrinsically linked, but crucially, it also undermines Johnson's Brexit credentials.
A trade deal with the United States is very important for Boris Johnson. That's what he was more or less promising when Britain left the European Union. That's what he was dangling in front of us, that everything was going to be okay. Britain would be an international player signing these trade deals and this and that. The one with America was the most important, and he's not got it. And it puts the relationship between Britain and the United States, the so-called special relationship, in perspective.
It would have been a political triumph for Prime Minister Boris Johnson, returning from a successful visit to the White House and brandishing on the floor of the House the details of a free trade agreement with Washington worth hundreds of billions of pounds. Now Johnson finds himself playing the waiting game and hoping against hope that his EU strategy pays off. Boris Johnson will head back to face his ministers to perhaps sell the idea of the UK joining the existing trade deal that's already up and running between the US, Canada, and Mexico. But for many inside government, and indeed the wider Conservative Party, it may well feel like a backward step. Amina Taylor, London.
As government ministers from the 27-nation EU arrived for a meeting at the European Council building in Brussels on Tuesday, it became apparent very quickly that the bloc is lurching towards a bitter showdown with some of its closest allies.
We see when we look at the Brexit agreements that they are not well implemented, that they are not fully respected. We see it with the AUKUS that there was some hidden things, so it's not the best context to have trust between us.
Senior European Commission officials told the EU affairs ministers that Brexit issues relating to Northern Ireland must be sorted out before January 1st. The Commission accuses Britain of breaking its end of the deal.
We need to rebuild the trust. We are ready to do that. We are working very intensely within the Commission. We want to arrive together with our UK partners in the joint solutions.
Outside the meeting, members of workers' unions gathered to warn of further problems for the EU unless poverty and exclusion are addressed.
People are starting to lose hope a bit in the EU project, and I think the Brexit was clearly a sign of that. And I think the recipe to change this is to have a more social Europe.
EU affairs ministers agreed to seek further information on the move by the US, Britain and Australia to scupper a multi-billion euro submarine deal that Paris had with Canberra.
We definitely remain committed to cooperation with our partners on the international stage, but any new alliances that may appear, of course, raise a number of questions.
The controversy surrounding the new US, UK and Australia weapons agreement known as AUKUS has been raised with Maurice Payne, the Australian Foreign Minister.
I inquired about the reasons behind the lack of prior consultation on AUKUS and regretted that this alliance excluded European partners.
Officials tell me Borrell did not get a straight answer as to why France and the EU were blindsided. It's clear, however, Canberra was lobbied by Washington and London. At present, it appears diplomacy in the West simply isn't working. Trust between allies is at an all-time low. How this will all play out is anybody's guess. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Young ministers from all walks of life took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to commemorate the revolution that took place on September 21, 2014. Following that revolution, the government of the former President Abd Rabbu Mansour Hadi collapsed.
The 21st September revolution means freedom and independence for us, which prompted 17 countries led by Saudi Arabia to launch a war on Yemen on 26 March 2015. This revolution is a resistance against the Israeli project in the region and a resistance against Saudi Arabia's miscalculations, which is prevalent in our country. So today we are paying the price for our freedom.
Our protest is in response to the call of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, and it is a commemoration of the anniversary of the 21st September revolution, during which Yemenis gained freedom, independence and sovereignty of their country.
Protesters said the revolution was triggered by the Yemenis themselves without any foreign intervention as a result of the deterioration of living conditions under the rule of the former president.
This large demonstration is evidence of the growing awareness among the Yemenis of the need to get out of the state of exclusion that prevailed under the rule of the former regime. The 21st September revolution saved Yemenis from external domination, and Yemenis today own their decision. The battles that are taking place today between Yemeni army and the Saudi-backed forces are the result of the Yemenis' exit from Saudi control.
We came out today to announce to the world that the September 21st revolution is the revolution of all free Yemenis, and to affirm our rejection of foreign domination and our boycott of proxies and traitors, whether in Yemen or the rest of the Arab countries.
Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi was backed by Saudi Arabia, that even waged an ongoing war to reinstate him. The Saudi led war on the country has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others since 2015.
Yemenis say the revolution was aimed at preserving the sovereignty of their country, which was under the control of the US and Saudi proxies. They believe that the Saudi brutal war on their country is the price for the freedom they have gained. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. President, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We're working with the P5 plus one to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said, pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appear to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
The Taliban has unveiled the name of 17 individuals as the newly appointed high-ranking officials for some ministries and other key governmental bodies, such as the country's Directorate of Atomic Energy. The Taliban claim they have done their best to include a number of well-educated people to the new list of the group's acting cabinet ministers.
The Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan keeps trying to appoint more professional
and well-educated people as top government officials in order to offer better service to our nation and strengthen Islamic governance system here.
The Taliban's move to appoint 17 new top government officials comes as the group's leadership had already pledged to establish an inclusive government. However, many here in Afghanistan believe the symbolic presence of some officials on behalf of some ethnic groups does not mean that the Taliban is trying to form an inclusive government.
We are waiting for establishment of a real inclusive government, and Taliban must accept such demand of the nation. This is because we are facing serious challenges such as joblessness and poverty.
In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman says the current government is an interim one and that works are underway to establish an inclusive government. According to the group, the future Afghan government will convince the world to recognize the Taliban-appointed government as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. The Taliban are struggling to form their government, while the Resistance Front in Panjshir Valley says it will never accept the rule of the Taliban over Afghanistan unless they say yes to the main demands of Afghans, demands such as forming a real inclusive government that does not deprive women and girls of their basic rights and paying respect to social and cultural liberties of people. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
According to the results of parliamentary elections in Russia, United Russia ruling party received a constitutional majority in the State Duma. The Communist Party took the second place, with the Liberal Democratic Party the third one. Then goes Fair Russia and New People. Thus, these five parties overcome the 5% barrier to enter the State Duma. United Russia is promoting President Vladimir Putin's agenda, which is also enshrined in last year's social amendments to the Constitution.
I want to thank all our voters who voted for United Russia and our candidates. This is a great trust and no less great responsibility for us. I also want to thank those who voted for other political parties. We respect your position and the choice you made.
The State Duma is elected in Russia for a five-year term under a mixed system. 225 deputies, according to party lists, another 225 in single-mandate constituencies in one round. The results haven't been without controversy, however. There have been widespread accusations of fraud and misconduct. Throughout the 3 days of voting, many videos shared online appeared to show voters and officials stuffing ballot boxes with multiple voting slips. In Moscow, some opposition figures accused officials of delaying the release of online voting results to give them an opportunity to manipulate. In response, Kremlin hailed the parliamentary elections as open, competitive, and honest.
Voter turnout was notably high, especially on the last day of voting. This election will also be remembered by a large number of candidates.
The team of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny accused the authorities of foul play, declaring all the victories against his candidates they supported as part of a controversial smart voting scheme as falsification. Earlier before the elections, Russia's telecom watchdog demanded the Navalny app be removed from App Store and Google Play based on a ruling by the Russian Prosecutor General's office.
For the first time this year's federal elections in Russia took place over 3 days. This year, election organizers have also introduced electronic voting devices. So far, residents of only seven regions in Russia have been able to vote using these devices. According to the Constitution, the new State Duma should meet on the 30th day following the election day.
But the president has the right to convene the first meeting of the lower house of parliament even earlier than this date. The Russian president has already exercised this right after previous elections. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says Iran is ready to resume talks on restoring the 2015 nuclear deal very soon. However, he says the U.S. is sending a negative signal by keeping and even intensifying sanctions on Iran. In an interview with U.S. media, Amir Abdollahian said Washington has taken no action to prove its readiness to return to the deal. He said the existing U.S. approach contradicts President Joe Biden's criticism of its predecessor's policy toward Iran. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal back in 2018 and reimposed crippling sanctions on Iran. Tehran, still adhering to the deal, began reducing its nuclear deal-related commitments a year later. Since the Biden administration took office, Iran and the remaining signatories to the deal have held six rounds of talks in Vienna in an effort to revive the accord. For more on that, we're now joined by our correspondent, Toma Lezgi, who's with us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Homa, what details do you have to share with us and our viewers?
Yes, Badia, that's right. So six rounds of negotiations have been held, of course, under the previous administration of Hassan Rouhani. And now it seems that we're going to have a resumption of these talks. We don't know when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. Of course, we're expecting a new team from the Iranian side. But of course, I guess the fundamental policies that have been pursued by the Iranian side are not changing when it comes to the demands that Iran is making in these talks. We also heard the U.S. President Biden at the UN General Assembly saying that the United States is also prepared to return to full compliance. But the key question here is, what is full compliance as far as Iran is concerned and as far as the U.S. is concerned? Those are questions that, of course, have been raised time and time again during the Vienna talks. For instance, Iran saying that it wants all of the U.S. sanctions, both the JCPOA-related ones and also the additional sanctions imposed under the Trump administration, to be fully removed. And at the same time, it wants to verify their removal before it returns to full compliance. This was seen as a sticking point in the talks. Another issue, of course, has been what sanctions the U.S. is prepared to lift. Apparently, the U.S. was not willing to lift all of the sanctions that Iran was asking for, and also Iran calling for guarantees that the JCPOA will indeed remain alive and there won't be another decision by this or another U.S. administration, for instance, to withdraw from it and to simply violate it. So we'll have to see, of course. The readiness has been expressed by all sides that they want these talks to resume. And, of course, everyone has expressed hope that they hope that these continuation of these talks will lead to the revival of the deal. But, of course, it has been a very complicated process.
All right. Thanks, Homa Lezgi, joining us from the Austrian capital, Vienna. Joining us, though, on tonight's Spotlight, we have journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, who's joining us from Belgrade. And also we have journalist and author Daniel Azar, who's with us from New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Mr. Bosnich in Belgrade. It's great to have you with us here on Press TV Spotlight. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, says that Iran is ready to resume talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal, but the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is sending, quote-unquote, negative signals and a negative sign by keeping illegal sanctions on Tehran. In your opinion, why is the U.S. Keeping those sanctions in place?
Well, we've mentioned this before in earlier discussions on the topic, and that is because there's a very, very powerful Israel lobby in the United States, which has incredible power over both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And there are costs to pay if you make moves against the Israel lobby in U.S. politics. So Biden has not yet arranged permission, in effect, from Israel to take action on this topic. And that's the crux of the problem, although most people don't want to talk about that in the United States.
Let's cross over to Daniel Azar in New York. It's great to have you with us here on the program. Mr. Azar, the top Iranian diplomat, he said that Biden needed to take back or rather needed to back up, excuse me, his talk of diplomacy with concrete actions to show Iran that Washington is serious about restoring the nuclear deal. Is Washington serious, in your opinion, or does it have ulterior motives regarding the revival of the deal?
I don't think it is serious, no. I think that it wants to revise the deal, take into account a whole range of non-nuclear activities by Iran, which is clearly beyond the scope, beyond the logic of the 2015 nuclear accord. So I think that that essentially is going to kill any hope of reviving the deal. Your previous guest is correct that the Israeli lobby, pro-Israel lobby, is a major force behind this kind of thinking. But equally important are the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia. The U.S. has constructed an entire defense network based on reigning in Iran, and Biden is not willing to alter that in any significant way. In fact, he wants to tighten the circle around Iran and use a revived 2015 nuclear accord as a means of doing so.
So I had this question scheduled for later on, but as you brought it up, I'm going to address it to both of you right now. Mr. Bosnich, who benefits from this limbo, from this uncertainty of the Iran nuclear deal?
Well, the military-industrial complex, because it allows them to lobby for further investment in so-called defensive measures against Iran. I mean, it's an absurdity on the face of it. Iran poses no military threat whatsoever to the United States, and Iran poses no military threat to anyone in the region. Iran is a strong country, has a large population, a well-educated population, and Iran has the right to defend itself. But who benefits from the limbo? The limbo benefits those who hate Iran, those who want to destroy the Iranian economy, who want to destabilize Iran, and to make Iran a non-player in its own region. Those are the persons and the states and the entities that are benefiting. And you are correct, your other guest is correct in saying that it is not only the Israel lobby, but there is a very strong lobby led largely by Saudi Arabia, which also wants to restrict the ability of Iran not just to develop its nuclear energy industry, but to restrict Iran's ability to exist as a stable economy.
Daniel Azar, same question to you.
Well, I mean, I think I agree. I would just add that that Iran, by allying itself with China and to a certain degree with Russia as well, that Iran now is kind of a frontline state. America is pressing its offensive against both Moscow and Beijing, and it sees Iran as being kind of a cat's paw for those two countries. So therefore, for a variety of reasons, U.S. hostility to Iran is extremely high. It's actually only increasing. So therefore, it wants to use, I said before, a revived version of the 2015 nuclear accord in order to put Iran even more on the defensive. So Iran, I mean, I can't imagine Iran ever saying yes to that. And if Biden were to drop his non-nuclear demands, there would be a storm in Washington among pro-Israel, pro-Saudi, pro-Gulf forces, as well as those who are most hostile to Russia and China, which essentially means 95% of the entire U.S. establishment.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. Lazar. Iran announced that the new administration will resume talks in Vienna, but according to the foreign minister, the Raisi administration neither accepts the U.S.'s unconstructive behavior, nor will it forestall Iran's progress based on Washington's habitually empty promises. The survival of the deal now is basically on the line. Given that Washington is the one that walked away from the international accord, it should be Washington that remedies what it has done first. Do you agree with that?
Oh, I do agree. yes, of course, legally, there's no doubt about that. The U.S. is the one which broke the deal, and the U.S., therefore, should be the one which which apologizes for so doing so and enters back into the deal with no other, you know, preconditions. But the U.S. is not going to do that. As I said before, the U.S. is now is making a raft of non-nuclear demands, which it insists that Iran agreed to as a precondition for any revival of the 2015 nuclear accord. So that's why I think that the negotiations are stalled while they'll go nowhere. I mean, I've always argued the 2015 accord is essentially doomed.
Mr. Bosnian, shouldn't it be Washington demonstrating its seriousness in returning to the deal after the former President Donald Trump withdrew the U.S. From the deal unilaterally, also coupled with Joe Biden's criticism of his predecessor's policy toward Iran?
Absolutely correct. There's no doubt about it that the initiative to destroy the deal, to block the deal, and to end the deal came from the United States, and the United States did not have grounds for making that move. But you have to remember that U.S. politics is very much a charade. The candidates say what they like during the election term. Whoever wins the election then pursues whatever policies he or she wants to pursue because there's no accountability. There's no recall. There's no way to force the president to fulfill his promises. There's no way to hold Biden to what he said about the deal. In effect, what happens is every 4 years, the American public is lied to by two candidates who vary on some domestic policy lines, but on international politics, they follow the state line. And the state line is directly dictated to the president by the military-industrial complex that buys all the members of Congress via bribery. So you are not dealing here with a rational, logical progression. You are dealing here with a facade, with a charade politics. And the only way to respond to this is to stand firm and to seek support from other countries which have great power, such as Russia, such as China, and other independent countries around the world. There are still a few of them, and they need to speak out. And they should speak out not just in this forum, but they should also speak out at the United Nations.
Daniel Azar, a major question here is what assurances can be given that another administration doesn't just come along and leave the deal again like Donald Trump did? Basically, I'm asking, should the U.S. be trusted?
Well, I mean, first of all, number one, I assume the deal will not go through. I assume that Joe Biden will blame it on Iran. And, of course, he'll declare America as guiltless, and America, by definition, is always guiltless. But I think that if by some miracle Joe Biden did go through with the deal, did re-enter the deal, if by some absolute miracle the negotiations in Vienna were successful, then yes, I think there's a very good chance that if the Republicans come back into office in 2024, the first thing they will do will be to abandon this deal.
Mr. Bosnich, would you like to weigh in on that for us, please?
Well, I fully agree, and I think that any deal that's ever signed with the United States of America as it stands now needs to be secured by severe penalty clauses. And those penalty clauses have to be in the language that they understand, and they only understand one language, and that is the language of money. Immense financial penalties for violating the deal. And those financial penalties need to be paid into a third party that's independent, and the monies must flow to Iran to not just punish the violator of the deal, but to also compensate Iran for the immense losses caused by the sanctions. And I can say that those must be adding up into the hundreds of billions of dollars already, and I think that that would cause some pain in Washington if such money had to be deposited in a neutral third party before any deal would take effect. They only understand money. Mammon is their god, and you have to speak to him in those terms.
Daniel Azar, Iran's foreign minister, has echoed a comment brought up many times before. The reality of the matter is that for years, this is, of course, the comments of the foreign minister, the reality of the matter is that for years, we have not obtained any benefits from the JCPOA. So the question is, why has Iran shouldered the responsibility of keeping the JCPOA afloat without gaining anything from it?
That's a good question, actually. I think that Iran has little to lose at this point by going along with the Vienna negotiations. I mean, it knows that the negotiations are a farce. It has every reason to believe they will go nowhere. But it has, I think it's rational for Iran to sort of string the U.S. along, to go along with this process, and to make a good faith effort to see these negotiations through to conclusion, even though it knows that's extraordinarily unlikely. Because I think not to do so would give a huge advantage to the U.S. It would allow the U.S. to portray Iran as being recalcitrant, being unwilling to talk, being essentially beyond the pale, and therefore would justify offensive military actions by the U.S. and Israel. So I think that Iran is correct to go to sort of, you know, follow through on this diplomatic process, even though it knows that it's likely not to lead to anything good.
And Mr. Bozic, same issue I'd like you to address as well. Iran has basically been, I think, in real terms, has been the only country that has been adhering to the JCPOA, but it has been gaining nothing from it during this time.
Well, you know, these are the facts of life on this planet today. We live in a world which is largely controlled by the United States and its colonial hold over other nations. You'll notice that the European powers that are supposed to be assisting in resolving this deal actually have no say in Washington. They can negotiate with Iran, they can come up with whatever solutions they like, but until they start to behave like independent states, nothing will happen. So what we're really dealing with here is the imperial empire structure of U.S. control of this world. And I do agree with your other guest that Iran must continue in good faith. Iran must do everything it can to demonstrate to the public of the world what kind of an adversary Iran faces. And I think it's very important that you here on Press TV discuss it, and that your representative at all talks speak to the media openly and explain what happens behind closed doors, because even the American people would never believe the way their own government treats other countries. That information needs to be shared. And then perhaps you can apply some pressure on the United States, both internally and internationally. Stay the course, be clear, state your rights, defend them, and hope that there are still a few honest people in Washington who will open their mouths and say that this is unfair.
Mr. Lazar, how would you rate Europe's performance regarding the JCPOA? For example, their commitments, their stance on the U.S. abruptly leaving the deal. Have the Europeans held up their end in all of this?
No, quite the contrary. They have failed to uphold their responsibilities by upholding the pact against U.S. attacks. This has been the most shocking development, you know, thing that's happened since 2015. Germany, France, they have not gone along at all. They have not defended the integrity of the Vienna process. And the Europeans, have learned, you know, where things lie thanks to Biden's nuclear deal with Australia, which is a dramatic rebuff, stab in the back to France. So the U.S. treats its European allies with contempt, yet these same allies are afraid to essentially buck U.S. authority in any way. And Iran has been a primary victim of that European cowardice.
John Bozic, last question to you. How would you rate Europe's performance when you look at the JCPOA?
Zero. I'm sorry to say it, but France is here, as your other guest just mentioned. France has itself just been stabbed in the back, and its inaction is demonstrating that France is not a world power, Germany's inaction is demonstrating that Germany is not a world power and that they are just as much a colonial asset of the United States as they were years ago. This is a bad indication of the way the world is going, and I think that Iran is doing the best that it can and the best that anybody could under the circumstances, and I have to praise you for your patience. I must say that you need to stand by your position. It's the legal and correct position, and you need to recruit support from other countries that have received the hard end of the stick from America, because Iran is not alone. You are being targeted now, but you are just one of the many countries that has suffered this kind of treatment by the U.S. empire.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for the show. Thanks to journalist and political analyst John Bosnich, joining us from Belgrade. Also thanks to journalist and author Daniel Lazar, speaking to us from New York. And allow me to thank my guests for staying with us on this edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding IRIB English Radio.
Arbain Walking History. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said, Arbain has arrived again as the greatest ever gathering in the history of mankind. Millions of people from many countries start walking the 80-kilometer distance from Najaf to Karbala to mark the most prominent symbol of humanity and freedom, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The glory of the event is not describable at all, as no camera is capable of capturing its grandeur, and no tongue is able to talk on it. Hundreds of thousands of pilgrims, mostly Iraqis, start their walking from hundreds of kilometers away from Karbala. Houses, shops, Husseiniyas, mosques, and tourist buildings have all been dedicated to the zealous pilgrims and lovers of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, is one of the masters of the youth of paradise, as Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said on many occasions. The Holy Prophet also said, Indeed, there is a warmth for Hussein in the hearts of the faithful which will never cool down. In recent years, over 20 million people have converged in the largest ever gathering of human beings in history in Iraq, all of whom walk towards a magnet with the universal motto of The love of Hussein has gathered us here. Arbaeen marks the 40th day after the martyrdom of the Prophet's younger grandson, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The walking pilgrims follow in the footsteps of Lady Zainab, peace be upon her, who marched towards the tomb of his brother to relate him the hardships and calamities that had befallen on her after her brother's martyrdom. Pilgrimage on foot is the preferred way of pilgrimage throughout history. For instance, Prophet Adam, peace be upon him, 70 times performed the pilgrimage of the symbolic house of God in Mecca on foot. Many religious leaders have done this in different eras. The Holy Prophet's elder grandson, Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, used to perform the Hajj pilgrimage barefoot. The Caesar of Rome had vowed to walk to Beit al-Maqaddas if he triumphed over Iranians. So, after defeating Iranians, he walked from his palace in Constantinople to Beit al-Maqaddas in Palestine. The walk of Arba'in was very difficult and could even be fatal during the rule of the former Iraqi dictator Saddam. But after the ouster of the dictator, millions of Iraqis and non-Iraqis have rushed every year for this unique event. According to statistics, in 2003, some 3 million people took part in the Arba'in walk. But the numbers increased every year. In 2012, more than 10 million people had participated in the event, and the number reached 15 million next year, in 2013. The number increased to nearly 20 million in recent years, despite the threats of the savage ISIL terrorists. What is spectacular and noteworthy in this huge gathering is the participation of Muslims from all denominations, both Sunnis and Shias, and the faithful from other religions such as Christians, Zoroastrians, Sabians, and Izzadis. The day of Ashura has transcended history and geography. It keeps impacting pure consciences and the hearts of the faithful. The Arba'in walk has had no precedent in the history of mankind. This has an outward appearance, but the inward is far deeper and glorious and effective as it builds the spirit and makes the individual more prepared for marching in the hardships of life against tyranny and corruption. The body of the pilgrim is exhausted in the long walk, but the spirit becomes stronger and stronger. Those who participate in the walk of Arba'in practice altruism and sympathy for all mankind. They come out of the boundaries of their mean desires and personal interests. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, addressing a number of Iraqi hosts of pilgrims in 2019, said, "The Arba'in walk is really quite a unique event. We have not seen either in our own era or throughout history such a gathering and such a move that occurs and keeps growing year after year. This is unique. This movement of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, plays a role in the cognizance of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. Arba'in, with this move that mainly is performed between Najaf and Karbala in the walk every year, has been universalized. The eyes of the peoples of the world have been drawn to this movement. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, and the cognizance of him have been universalized thanks to this great popular movement. This is the blood of Hussein, son of Ali ibn Abi Talib, which is gushing forth and refreshing us every day. And this is the message of Ashura, which is emitted from the throats of Abu Abdullah al-Hussein and Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon them, in absolute loneliness and has been engulfing the world. The Arba'in walk is undoubtedly the greatest gathering in the entire human history, no matter how much the Western media try to ignore it. For sure, in the near future, this monopoly of the American Zionist-controlled media will end, and the peoples of the world will see the unmatched love and passion for Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the Lord of freedom seekers and those who love justice." Thank you.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is...